Jeff Blair loves to commute. Let him join you on yours. Subscribe to podcasts of The Jeff Blair Show at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. On demand. On demand. On demand. On demand. Agree with everything he says, and you'll get along fine. This is the Jeff Blair Show on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
So much coverage of hockey trade deadline day on Monday. How much? Ha! Glad you asked. Have you got color in your cheeks? TV coverage will begin at 8 a.m. on Sportsnet Ontario, Sportsnet.ca, and Sportsnet Now. Hosts and analysts include Darren Millard, Mike Johnson, Nick Kyprios, Kelly Rudy, Christine Simpson, Elliot Friedman, Chris Johnson, John Shannon, Jeff Merrick, Glenn Healy, Doug McLean, Darren Pang, Craig Simpson, Damian Cox, George Strombolopoulos, Sophia Jerskowitz, and Sportsnet's reporters across the country and a partridge in a pear tree. Radio coverage will be simulcast on Sportsnet 360 from 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. Hey, that means we're on TV and radio. Hey, lucky viewers. That'll be from our Hockey Central studio. Don't forget, that is also the day that Dean Blundell and company premieres at 5:30 a.m. And George Strombolopoulos will host a special edition of Hockey Central at noon. You can get in-depth coverage and follow our trade tracker on sportsnet.ca. So there you go. If anybody farts in the NHL world on Monday, you'll hear it here. You'll see it here. Who knows? You may even smell it here. Scott Morrison of Hockey Central is one of our 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. One of our number of Hockey Central analysts will be working on Monday. Scott Morrison joins us on the Jeff Blair Show. So, Mr. Morrison, Daniel Winnick's gone. Cody Franson's gone. Mike Santorelli's gone. Those were kind of the moves. Those were kind of the easy moves for David Nonis, weren't they?
I was just going to say, hope we don't have scratch and sniff TV or radio on Monday after what that introduction.
I don't know.
We're going to have to get you a suit.
I'll tell you what, that high def, man, that high def.
You just never know.
Anyhow.
What they've come up with lately. Yeah.
I may have oversold it. I apologize. I may have oversold it a bit in my zest to,
Well, when you started off, I thought you were reading the phone book there for a minute, but a few people working on Monday, let's put it that way.
There will be a few
people working already with some of the early moves, as you mentioned, and to your point, Jeff, Dave Nonis is chipping away at the moves that he had to make because they had to get rid of the unrestricted free agents and get some draft picks back. Because that's what they need in abundance right now is as many picks as they can get for this draft and the next one to start the rebuild or retool or whatever you want to call it.
I think they did really well in the Daniel Winnick deal, don't you?
I think they've done well in both deals. I mean, the tendency for people is to fall in love with the guys you've got. And Winnick was real good for this team, probably had more impressive numbers than he should have had, meaning, in a perfect world on a team that performed at the level that this one did for a while and perhaps should have for a longer while, he would have fallen into a different role. But, amazingly enough that over the stretch that they've been in a free fall, he was a plus player, like a plus 14 or something crazy like that. So he's been real good for them, and we kind of had him on the radar. I remember doing a show with Doug McLean, and we did a Pittsburgh game a couple of weeks ago and talked about the wants and needs of the Penguins, and we said, Doug threw it right out. I said, they need a top-nine forward who can do this, this, and this, and then Doug threw it right out and said Daniel Winnick was the perfect fit, and obviously it came together. So they got a couple picks. They got a guy in Zach Sill who will bounce back and forth, I would suspect, between the minor leagues and the Leafs. And if he works hard and does the things that he's capable of, could be a third or fourth line guy with the Leafs. So, at the end of the day, they've watched guys walk out unrestricted and got nothing back in return, so they got a pretty good return in this regard.
Yeah, and I mean, people are going to say, well, why isn't the second, why is the second pick in 2000 and 2016 and not 2015? I just think anytime you can get a second pick, anytime you can get a first or a second pick for a guy who's going to walk at the end of the year, to me, you've done okay.
Yeah, and they got two picks,
a fourth and a second, yeah.
The second, who knows where Pittsburgh's going to be a year from now, and when you look over the history of the draft, second-round picks, they're very valuable, or can be very valuable if you do your homework and you draft well, and you can turn that into something, and this is going to be more than a one-summer project for the Maple Leafs, so to get a pick in both drafts is I think, Dave Nonis did very well.
And I think, as I know a couple of people in Hockey Central have pointed out, that the idea behind accumulating draft picks is that also puts you in a position to possibly move up in the draft. Maybe not this year's draft, but who knows? It puts you in a position, if you can trade picks, there's a chance, especially a second round pick, there's a chance you might be able to move up and get a player you really want in the draft. Like, they really are valuable. There's such a valuable currency in a salary cap league, because literally, Scotty, you can do whatever you want with the draft pick.
Yeah, there's no question about it, Jeff. You're spot on, and it allows you a couple of options, and that's one of them. And if you've got, as they do, a couple of first-round picks, you've got multiple second- and third-round picks, yeah, you can package them together. You can put yourself in a position that you can move up some spots, potentially, if that's what your goal is in the first round. And then beyond that, the more you have, the better are the odds that you're going to draft a player that's going to help you down the road. And, I heard a scout once say that, if you only have one, then the odds aren't as good that you're going to nail it. If you have two or three, then the odds are better that you're going to nail it and come out of it with a player. So as a general manager, it gives you a couple of different options for sure. And as you mentioned, one of the most valuable currencies in hockey right now in the salary cap world and the way this league has evolved and gotten younger is you've got to be good at the draft and player development.
Scotty Morrison of Hockey Central in conversation with us on the Jeff Blair Show. One of the stories, and it was on the CSN Philly website. Of course, the Flyers are in town tonight to play the Leafs. And there was also some talk about this player possibly being connected with the Chicago Blackhawks as well. One of the guys who really intrigues me is Jaromir Jagr for a variety of reasons. What do you think his destination might be at the deadline, and what type of team should be looking to add this guy?
Well, he certainly, from the comments that came out yesterday or the day before, made it sound like he's not entirely pleased with how the world has evolved, even though the team's gotten better with Lou Lamoriello and the two assistant coaching changes behind the bench, that it hasn't necessarily been a good move for him in terms of ice time and his enjoyment. And a lot of people have connected him to, obviously a contender that he would be a decent kind of rental and a guy that could step in and maybe add some offense. And I agree with all that maybe that's what he can provide, just some scoring depth for a playoff-bound team. Having said that, there's some people that wonder and are concerned, some hockey people you talk to, that as good as he's been and continues, he's in great physical shape and all the rest of it, is that he doesn't play the game at a speed that's necessarily something that would gel with all the teams or a lot of teams, and that he could be a player that could be a little bit miscast depending on the club he goes to. So I think that's a factor that a general manager would have to take into account.
I guess one of the other teams that people will be watching, not just at the trade deadline, but certainly the days leading up to it, the Chicago Blackhawks, if they put Patrick Kane in long-term disability, that does open the possibility of adding a forward. Renaud Lavoie is one of the people that really talking a lot about the possibility of the Flyers adding a forward. Where do you see them going?
The Flyers or the Hawks?
I'm sorry, the Hawks. The Hawks, yes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously they've got some relief down the stretch with Kane going on long term, but again, all they can really do is bring on a rental. because beyond this season, they're going to be in cap jeopardy. And that's why this Kane injury is so acute on so many levels, is because this was really a year they had to take a run for it, because they're going to be buried under some big contracts next year with Kane and Tay's new deals kicking in. They're still paying Hossa a ton of dough. Crawford's got a big ticket, and on it goes. So there's a lot of money going to be tied up in only a handful of players. So for them to take on a deal that's got term and dollars is going to be very difficult, and just make a bigger challenge for Stan Bowman in the summer. So I think all they can really do at this point is add some, it would be to find a rental and add that to the mix, and otherwise hope that they've got enough depth and savvy and experience that you try to ride it through as best you can, and hope that, you know, they brought up Caravana from the minors. This is a kid that they think has the potential to be a real good NHLer. You hope that you sort of strike lightning in a bottle, if you will, with a call up like that that just gels at the right time with the group you've got. But it's a difficult situation, no doubt.
Scott, we appreciate you doing this today. Looking forward to your work on Monday. Should be hectic. Should be a lot of fun. Hopefully somebody will save some trades for Monday. Hopefully they don't use all the trades up.
Well, you know what, Jeff? We see it year after year that, you know, because of the salary cap world, because points are so precious, mm-hmm. when you get into these playoff races, some managers like to get their business done sooner than later, which makes sense, but inevitably, when you still get down to Monday, we still end up getting a bunch of deals. So in last year, you know, the likes of a Gabrick and San Luis and Luongo on the eve of it, all those dominoes fell. So I'm sure we'll be busy enough on that day for sure.
Thanks, Scott.
Okay, Jeffy, take care.
It's Scott Morrison, Hockey Central analyst. He'll be part of our coverage on Monday. And again, just to refresh, the TV coverage will begin at 8 a.m. on Sportsnet Ontario, sportsnet.ca, and Sportsnet Now. Radio coverage. We will be simulcast on Sportsnet 360 from 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. from the Hockey Central studio. Dean Blundell and company, by the way, the morning show will premiere at 5:30 a.m. on Trade Deadline Monday. So there you go. We'll have you covered stem to stern, and all the breaking NHL news, the breaking NHL trades. Trade deadline day is Monday. I was lucky enough, or I have been lucky enough to go to Cuba a couple of times in holiday, and once for work when the Baltimore Orioles played an exhibition game in Cuba years ago. It's a difficult, and again, this is, I'm talking about back in, I want to say 2000, no, I want to say 1997, 1998. It's a difficult place to describe to people who haven't been there before. It's difficult because you don't want to be trite. You want to walk the fine line between describing a society that is kind of cool, a society that has a lot of throwback elements to it, but at the same time, a society that has a lot of issues, to say the least, when it comes to human rights, a lot of issues when it comes to the very day-to-day existence of the people. I have a friend who says it's the great white hunter mentality that you have to fight against, which is, you're the white North American guy going down to Cuba. Wow, isn't this interesting? Look at how quaint these people are. It's a place that literally, literally overwhelms your senses. Jorge Arajuar is a senior writer with Vice Sports. And he has penned a remarkable series for Vice. And I tweeted out a link to it earlier. It's not just about Cuban baseball. That's certainly a sport very close to Jorge's heart. I've known him for a long time. I know soccer is as well. But it's about Cuban life and about the life of people around baseball in Cuba. And we're very pleased at this time to be joined by Jorge Arajuar, senior writer for Vice Sports. Jorge, it's a terrific series. You know, I What was your initial reaction stepping off the plane in Cuba?
Firstly, thanks for having me on, Jeff. You have to fight, like you were saying. I mean, you have to fight some of that initial reaction to, like, wow, you know, this is like stepping back in time, or, you know, like you're trying to, you know, sort of set this scene of what you see there. But at the same time, you kind of don't want to glorify things that shouldn't be glorified, or you don't want to sort of be insensitive to what people's daily lives are like. And I think that was, for me, my intent was to just try to get to know how people live on a day-to-day basis and sort of go beyond what the typical Cuba stories have been, when you had reporters go in there and just sort of very mechanically write about, you know, the country system and all the things that exist there. So for me, I just really wanted to get to know people and sort of have these conversations about what life was like there. Because, I mean, I think there is such a mystery, especially for Americans, you know, because they can't, you know, easily go there, legally go there, that I think there's like this mystery element to it. And I think you just kind of wanted to sort of remove that and just sort of talk about the reality.
You got a chance to not only spend time with the Cuban Derek Jeter, but you also got to, and the story that really kind of got me is the Bat Boys, the 50-year-old Bat Boys. Tell us a little bit about that. And again, we have linked the story, but just I remember when the Orioles played the Cuban national team in an exhibition game, and there was a real big deal made about it, and there was a cultural festival surrounding it. It was basically for a lot of American reporters and a lot of American artists, kind of the first trip to Cuba. But what I remember is Gabriel Pierre, who is a longtime mainstay of the national team, third baseman. I remember him leaving the ballpark in his jersey. In his uniform, getting in the car, and he had all the Baltimore Orioles players sign his jersey. And it was remarkable, you know, because we come from a culture where, you know, we see baseball players, getting into their luxury vehicles, or, you know, everything's taken care of them. And here is this guy. This guy was going to this, you know, getting into it was an okay car, but nothing spectacular, with a couple of kids. And he's still got his jersey on, shirt is untucked, he's got his glove with him, he hasn't showered, he hasn't changed, and he said, guys, sign the jersey. It's remarkable.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, I've been around a lot of Latin American baseball, so, you know, you see some of these guys that are, you know, older guys that are part of a team, but, I mean, so this guy really struck me because he did seem a little bit older than most that I've ever seen. And I think, I mean, we talk about fandom here, what the sport means here to people, but when you think about someone who's basically devoted their entire life to being around the game, 56-year-old man wanting to be a bat boy just because he wants to be around the game. I think you get the understanding of what, you know, how this goes beyond sport. I mean, it's cultural, it's societal, it's something that's just ingrained into a society there. And, you know, in Cuba, that's sort of the way it is. I mean, at the Estadio Latinoamericano, which is where the Industriales play, they have a statue basically in the stands of one of their number one fans who passed away, I think it was more than 10 years ago, but there's an actual statue of a guy in the stadium in one of the seats. I mean, that just kind of shows the devotion that you have and how important it is to day-to-day life, that it goes beyond sport. And I think that's something that really struck me, and just having a conversation with him, just kind of wanting to find out, you know, why does he do it? You know, why? It's certainly not a glory job. You're picking up bats, you're taking stuff, equipment out for batting practice, and then you're the last guy to leave at midnight. But it's this devotion that you have to the sport and just to the team in general. I think it's really kind of talks a little bit about sort of the alliances that people form at Cuba.
In conversation with Jorge Araujo, senior writer for Vice Sports. When you went down to do this story, and it was, you know, just after the suggestion that relationships between the United States and Cuba were starting to normalize, when you got down there, what was the reaction of the Cuban people to that you know, to that fact? I mean, clearly I would think they're aware of it, but what were they expecting? Are they expecting a huge influx of American businesses? Are they expecting that their ball players, more and more of their ball players, will end up in the majors?
I think there is that expectation that things are going to change. I mean, I think there's sort of a little bit of hesitancy too, because I think, you know, just talking to a few people there, they mentioned how, you know, they felt like there were other times when maybe there were going to be changes coming to the country, and it didn't happen, and it just ended up being disappointment. So I think they're a little bit hesitant to completely believe that things are going to open up, and that, you know, that they'll be able to maybe go out of the country and maybe visit the United States, visit relatives. But I think there is this sort of excitement. It was sort of a really unique and interesting time to be there. Just because, I mean, there is this news is all pretty much anyone wants to talk about in Cuba right now. It's just the opening up of the relations. It's such a huge topic that they all, people there just are very in anticipation of what could happen. And I think there's this sort of optimism in the country right now that maybe you might not have seen maybe 5 years ago. And I think just the news and the possibilities are what has people excited right now.
One of the articles you wrote as part of the diary, which really caught my attention, because I had no idea about this. Like a lot of people, I just assume Cuba's all about baseball, and it will always be about baseball. But as you point out, Cuba's becoming more and more about soccer. And I love the way you point out that with this new Cuba and these new relationships with other countries, soccer may end up, in fact, becoming kind of the new money sport to play, whereas baseball may be viewed as kind of a throwback to the, I'm not going to say the bad old days, but a throwback to the days of the Castro regime, and that, you know, baseball may actually have an image issue in Cuba in the next 5 years or so.
Yeah, I sort of was struck by how many kids really openly talk about how it's sort of soccer is like the new exciting sport. It is sort of in the way that I would imagine, you know, football here was maybe 40 years ago, where baseball was seen as this throwback, this old-time kind of sport. And then you have now, you know, the NFL here in the U.S. sort of took over, and now that's sort of the cachet sport. I mean, I don't necessarily think it's going to instantly happen. I think there's still a lot of impediments for soccer to become huge in Cuba, but you have sort of this youth push for it. And if things ever open up, I think you could see more money being invested in Cuban soccer. I mean, and when you look at it too, I mean, if Cuba can start developing decent soccer players who can play overseas, I mean, they don't need to depend on the U.S. market for that, just mm-hmm. like they'd have to do in baseball. I mean, they can go and play in Europe right now if they have good enough players, and they can make arrangements with countries that don't have an embargo against Cuban athletes or Cuba in general. So, I mean, I think the possibility there that if they can start developing, you know, a decent amount of players that can actually go overseas and play in the top leagues in the world, then you might see some of that. I mean, you might see the National Soccer League sort of become a bigger deal than it is right now. I think money-wise, it still has a long way to go because the government doesn't really invest a lot of money into it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, like you said, I mean, it is this image thing now where it's seen now as sort of the hip sport. I mean, you see a lot of people in Ronaldo jerseys there. You see a lot of Barcelona jerseys there. So you see sort of this new element of what soccer can be there.
Is it your sense that Cubans are going to be able to finally watch their baseball players, that it'll be a little easier for them to maybe watch major league games? Because I think a lot of people don't realize that a lot of times games involving the Cuban players, the players that have escaped from Cuba, they're not available in Cuba. Are we getting to the point where Cuban baseball fans may actually be able to see Yasiel Puig?
I think we are definitely getting closer to it. I mean, it was a big change, even just the fact that the Cuban government started showing one Major League Baseball game a week on Sundays. But like you said, I mean, they don't show games that involve, Cuban defectors. But I think those sort of attitudes are changing a little bit. I think the one guy that sort of like this section of guys that will always have trouble getting acceptance back into Cuba will be guys who left during, like, tournaments. So guys who defected during a tournament, for example, Aroldis Chapman left during a tournament in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
I think guys like that will find it difficult to be accepted back into Cuban society. But I think any of the other guys who left, like a Yasmani Tomas or Moncada who left, just at a different time, not during the tournament. I think those guys will find it a lot easier to get accepted back in the society. So I think if we're talking about just, you know, attitudes towards defectors changing, I think you have seen that. I think you have seen sort of this lessening of sort of this wall that used to exist. And I don't think we're that far away from seeing, you know, having the Cuban government to show more baseball games, where maybe you would see one of these guys that you know, maybe in the past they wouldn't have wanted to do. I mean, I don't think we're that far away to think that maybe in the next World Baseball Classic that a lot of these guys may be part of Team Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that would be I think that's sort of an exciting element to this, just from the strictly sport aspect of it, is I think a lot of these guys will sort of gradually be brought back into the fold.
Jorge, it was great talking to you again, and terrific work. It's, like I said, it was fascinating reading. We tweeted out a link to it. We'll do it again. And thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Jeff. Appreciate it.
Take care. That is Jorge Arajuar. He is a senior writer for Vice Sports. And you can follow him on Twitter, at Jorge Arajuar, last name Arangure. And I will tweet out the link to the Cuba Diaries. A remarkable piece of reporting and storytelling, most importantly, which when you do go down to Cuba, you do find yourself. Yeah, this sounds really trite, but it's true. It's like walking into a novel. That's the only way I can describe it. And we appreciate Jorge joining us. Time to join Mr. Strombolopoulos and Mr. Merrick for Off the Ice. And then when we get back, we will continue our baseball discussion. And who better to do that with than John Paul Morosi, the national baseball writer for Fox Sports. John Paul Morosi joins us when the Jeff Blair Show continues on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Subscribe to our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. No medical exam or health questions will be asked. Sportsnet 590, The Fan, on demand. Now more of the Jeff Blair Show on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
All right, we're back. Hockey Central at noon, just around the corner. Don't forget, by the way, again, Monday. I'm going to have my ugly mug in the television. Because they're simulcasting Hockey Central trade deadline day coverage on Sportsnet 360 as well as Sportsnet 590 The Fan. So be warned that I'll be on TV from 9 a.m. to 12. And I hope to Jesus somebody breaks a trade during that time. Or just, I hope to Jesus somebody makes a trade. Anyhow. John Paul Morosi is the national baseball writer for Fox Sports. Let's get him while we have him. He is in Arizona at the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim spring training complex. The Angels getting ready to hold, or Mike Socha getting ready to hold his media availability. John, thanks for doing this. The biggest story, of course, out of the Angels camp is Josh Hamilton's situation. What is the latest? What do we know?
Well, Jeff, as you said, Mike Socha, the Angels manager, expected to meet with the media here momentarily. I'm sure he'll be asked about Josh Hamilton's situation, having reports, obviously, that Hamilton is meeting with MLB officials regarding a disciplinary issue, which reports say is related to perhaps his drug history and a potential relapse here in the last several months. So at this point in time, Jeff, I don't know that there's going to be any announcement today necessarily from MLB about a suspension. But what I can say is, after speaking with a number of Angels players, including C.J. Wilson and Mike Trout, David Freese, there's a lot of concern in the clubhouse for Josh. And he's obviously struggled offensively and struggled with his health the last couple of years, with the Angels. But he's a very popular person in that clubhouse still. And a lot of just very genuine human concern their teammate and speaking with those three gentlemen I mentioned. And I think they don't even know at this point, Jeff, where exactly this is headed, if he's going to be suspended, what exactly has transpired. But obviously the general tenor is one of pretty serious concern.
Yeah, and a couple of things here. He's not reported to spring training in Arizona after undergoing surgery in his right shoulder. He was expected to be out until after the regular season begins. There's also a sense here that he may not have failed a test, that he, in fact, may have self-reported this to the commissioner's office.
Yes, and John Heyman has reported that from CBS, that that's, in fact, what has happened, that Hamilton self-reported the violation. Now, it's important to back up and have a little context here that of course, as a condition of Hamilton's reinstatement back in 2006 under Commissioner Bud Selig, he is tested for drugs three times per week.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a reinstatement that was obviously done at the discretion of the commissioner then in Selig's case, and so any violation of these provisions would also fall under the discretion of Commissioner Rob Manfred. In other words, he does not necessarily fit under the category of first-time offender or second-time offender.
Right.
He is effectively outside of that program because he had so many offenses during his suspensions in the minor league. So he really is a unique case for Rob Manfred to handle here. And again, this penalty, if there is one, will be at the commissioner's discretion. And as you point out, it's important to note that if, in fact, Josh self-reported this as John Heyman has reported, it actually is in keeping somewhat with his accountability in the past. He had two different alcohol relapses that we know of during his time with the Rangers, and he actually self-reported both of those to the team at that time. So he has been, as much as he has struggled with this, with his addiction, Jeff, he has been, I think, very forthright in acknowledging the times when he has slipped up, so to speak, and I think that's something that he is, again, reportedly has done again here in this instance.
John, again, I'm going to take advantage of having you while we have you. Let us know when Mike Socia shows up and you have to run, but the shifting focus, and it's not a very smooth transition, I admit that. Michael Saunders is out at least until the All-Star break after tearing his meniscus, shagging fly balls yesterday. He was, of course, supposed to be the Blue Jays' opening day left fielder. What trade options might present themselves to Alex Anthopoulos? Is there a team that we should perhaps be looking at if Alex decides to go the trade route?
Yes. I would say in general, Jeff, keep a close eye on the National League West, because the National League West has a number of teams with a good outfield surplus. The Rockies are one of them, with Charlie Blackmon, Chris Dickerson, that group, or Corey Dickerson, I should say. Chris Dickerson, of course, has signed with the Blue Jays already.
Mm-hmm.
They have Drew Stubbs as well. The Rockies have a good surplus. The Diamondbacks could potentially have a surplus, especially if Yasmani Tomas ends up playing the outfield. They may be able to move a Mark Trumbo, possibly David Peralta, who I like a lot. I think he'd be a very good fit for the Blue Jays. So the Diamondbacks are a potential fit. The Dodgers still have their outfield surplus there with Andre Ethier. So there are a lot of different options. And I do think, Jeff, that it's worth the Blue Jays' effort to try to find a major league, a proven major league solution there for left field. And here's why. You already have a question in center field with Pompey. You already have a question at second base in terms of who that's going to be. So I would say at this point in time, better to have a little bit of certainty in left field, because you also don't know about the half of the first base / DH mix, about if that's going to be a Navarro or Smoke, who really has struggled to assert himself as an everyday major league player during his opportunities in Seattle. So the Jays really seem to have a binary lineup. They have stars in several spots and then tremendous questions elsewhere. So I think the Jays may want to remedy that situation by getting a little more certainty in left field, because as we've seen before, Jeff, there's certainly no guarantee that even coming back and playing on the turf that Michael Saunders will be able to snap right back into his usual production after missing half the season with knee situation.
Your Fox Sports colleague Ken Rosenthal's reported that Francisco Rodriguez has agreed to a $13 million deal with the Milwaukee Brewers, 2 years with the team option for a third year. You surprised that he was able to get that term from Milwaukee?
That's a good contract. I mean, that's a very good contract, Jeff, for K-Rod. But I also think it's important to note he's still a relatively young pitcher. You look at his age and
33 only.
He has Exactly. He's, mm-hmm. I mean, K-Rod is, he is on track. If everything continues to go well for him, he could very easily become the all-time save leader in Major League Baseball. He's, he has more saves than Mariano Rivera at the same point in his career, and he had a very good season last year. So I think when you look at his overall package, what he brings, he gave them some stability. I know he tailed off a little bit towards the end of the season, but it's a very good signing, I think, for the Brewers, because it gives them it allows them to shift Jonathan Broxton more into an eighth inning role, and I think makes the rest of their bullpen slot in very nicely. Simultaneously, Jeff, this is not good news for the Phillies, who have lost yet another potential suitor for Jonathan Papelbon. So the Phillies' ongoing efforts to hasten their rebuild, this is not very good news for them in that respect, because that had obviously been one ongoing conversation throughout the offseason between the Brewers and the Phillies on Jonathan Papelbon.
I'm going to let you run and do some work, John. As always, appreciate it.
My pleasure, Jeff. I'll be listening to that show on Monday on trade deadline day, and please notify me immediately if the Wings get that right shot defenseman they've been needing for a couple of years, okay?
I will indeed do that.
Thank you, Jeff.
Take care.
Talk to you soon.
Yes, sir. That is John Paul Morosi, the national baseball writer for Fox Sports. What do you think he'd do if Dion Phaneuf was traded to the Detroit Red Wings? So that is the latest on Josh Hamilton. Just to put it in context, you know, of course, that Josh Hamilton has had a history of addiction issues. I understand there are fans out there that look at the amount of money these guys make and kind of roll their eyes. But I think anybody with any personal experience with any type of addiction, or who knows somebody who has an addiction, has got to, I mean, it's just got to rip your heart out to hear, Josh Hamilton. Again, according to John Heyman of CBS Sports, the suggestion is that he has self-reported cocaine use, possibly other substances as well, recreational substance use. Again, that from John Heyman of CBS Sports. This is a guy who's tested three times a week as part of his reinstatement program with Major League Baseball. And for him to take this step is... would indicate that this is a pretty serious bit of business on his part. Josh Hamilton was expected to be out until the start of the regular season with the shoulder injury. And as you heard Jean-Paul Morosi say from the Los Angeles Angels complex, he's a popular guy. He has his issues. He's had his issues, but he has turned into a very popular teammate. And for a lot of people around the Angels who have kind of had his back. And this is, I talked to somebody who played with him or actually coached him in Texas. And he was making the point that Josh is a unique guy. He can drive you nuts, but he's the type of guy whose back you really want to have. He's the type of guy you really want to look out for. You can just imagine for the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim, regardless of whether or not he was going to be available, regardless of whether or not he was even going to be able to contribute on a regular basis, the very story, the nuts and bolts of the story, has to be extremely disappointing and concerning to the members of the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim. So we may get more information on that today, on the status of Josh Hamilton. Again, it's important to note that initial information is that he self-reported the transgression to the commissioner's office. It does not appear to be the result of a failed drug test. So I don't know what that means in terms for discipline. This is kind of the first big case, if you want to call it that, for the new commissioner, Rob Manfred, who's certainly no stranger to this because he was Major League Baseball. He was the commissioner's office, their front man in all the drug testing issues and the negotiation of the collective bargaining agreement. So he would certainly have a lot of firsthand knowledge about this. He may, in fact, have been involved in the initial suspension of initial discipline with Josh Hamilton, but this nonetheless will be kind of his first big test, and again, we'll keep you informed on how that goes. So there you go, busy day. Michael Saunders, your opening day left fielder for the Toronto Blue Jays, not anymore. He is out, according to the team, until the All-Star break with a torn meniscus. Suffering the knee injury yesterday, shagging fly balls at one of the fields at the Bobby Maddox training complex, according to accounts, stepped on a soft spot around a sprinkler head. As he says, felt or heard the knee go pop. Michael Saunders now out at least until the All-Star break. He was counted on to provide a lot of the left-hand hitting offense that was going to be absent due to the trade of Adam Lind and the departure due to free agency of Melky Cabrera and Colby Rasmus. So there you go. Blue Jays position players scheduled to report today. First full workout tomorrow. And already you have an injury. That is it for us. Hockey Central at noon is next. We'll be back tomorrow. Have a great day, everybody.